This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, and streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me as usual is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
And this is a very special episode with The Fanatic being released this week. We are going to be looking at the very prolific John Travolta. And we always sort of kind of make fun of Nick Cage, Rich, and the amount of films he puts out each year. But not far behind him is old Mr. Travolta. And in fact, we've managed to come out with six, and it could have even been more films which have been out in the last, what would you say, 6-12 months?
Yeah, or certainly the last couple of years. I mean, we've dabbled in a little bit of Travolta with Life on the Line.
That's true.
A while back, but you know, we've really just completely overlooked him. We've often talked about, oh, we really need to cover more of his stuff, and this was a perfect opportunity. He actually went dark for a couple of years, and I think, I'm not sure if that was tied to his work on the American Crime Story show, which I haven't had a chance to watch yet, but I think it's on Netflix. I'll try and see that. But he did I Am Wrath, which we're not reviewing on this episode, which we've both seen and really enjoyed.
Yep.
And since then, so I think like there was a couple of years where he was making stuff, but you know, other stuff, but it wasn't getting released. Like, so we're going to be covering, well, if you want to sort of give a rundown of the shows.
So what we're covering tonight is we're going to kick off with his latest film, The Fanatic. Then we're going to move on to Speed Kills. Then another one which is quite infamous, Gotti. Then we're going to move on to Burning Rubber, Eye for an Eye, and we're going to round off with our DTV throwback, The Forger, which he made back in 2014. So without any further ado, let's crack on. So our first review this week is The Fanatic. Travolta stars as Moose, a functioning autistic who is a big fan of an action star called Hunter Dunbar, and his obsession grows from frustration and disappointment when he misses a couple of opportunities to meet him. Soon, Moose has gained entry into Dunbar's house and is learning the hard way you should never meet your heroes. So this film is notable for a number of reasons. Let's start with one of the more interesting ones, and that is the film is directed by Fred Durst, the front man of Limp Bizkit.
Yes, this is his third film as a director.
All right, it's his third film. That's interesting. And you know what? I have to say, he does a good job. It's a very, you know, there's no sort of serious inconsistencies here. There's a few artistic flourishes along the way. But I got no problem with Fred Durst as a director.
No, and he established himself making the Limp Bizkit music videos. Mm. So he'd done, I think, pretty, if not all of them, a good chunk of them throughout their time. Mm. I haven't seen his earlier two films, which the first was a drama with Jesse Eisenberg, and the second was a comedy with Ice Cube. So they're all very different films that he's gone for. But this, I think, is the first one that he's come up with the story for. Mm. And worked on the screenplay for, as far as I can tell. So this is like a passion project, I think.
And it is a subject which a number of other sort of star, you know, Hollywood people have sort of brought to the fore before. Like there's a very notorious film called Paparazzi.
Yeah, that came to mind when I was watching it as well.
Yeah, which I believe was produced by Mel Gibson.
Although
he's not actually in it. Had like Tom Sizemore as this sort of evil paparazzi guy.
He produced it, I think, and I think his brother appears in it. Mm. And I think that film was directed by a guy who used to be his assistant, or his like hair assistant or something. Something random like that. Yeah. It's called Cole Hauser, didn't it?
Yes, it did. We can't laugh about that, though, because who was it? It was John Peters? Used to be with Jerry Bruckheimer.
Oh, the super producer.
Yeah, yeah. He started off as a hairdresser, you know, hairdresser to the stars or whatever, and then ended up, as you say, being one of the big, Uber producers of the day.
The Batman films and stuff.
Batman films, Days of Thunder, I believe, as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're totally digressing. It's almost as if we're trying to avoid the elephant in the room, which is Travolta's performance as Moose. As I said, he's kind of playing what I would describe as a functioning autistic. He's reasonably sociable, but he has his tics, his stimming and things like that.
Yeah.
And his obsessive behavior, which sort of derails him a little bit. But I don't know. Do you know what really came to mind? It's the conversation that Robert Downey Jr.'s character has in Tropic Thunder with Ben Stiller's character. Mm-hmm. When they're talking about his...
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know the one. You don't even need to say it. I know
exactly. I'm not going to say it because I don't want to draw too much controversy. But, that's what I thought of when watching his performance. Because it is committed, that's for sure. Yeah. I just don't know what to make of it, to be honest. Now, you and I both have children who are on the autistic spectrum. So we have a certain amount of experience. Now, I'm not saying that all autistic children are the same. Of course not. It's a wide spectrum. And, you can kind of cherry pick which elements from it, are going to arise. So I can't call in on that at all. But I don't know. I just didn't know what to make of it. How about you, Rich?
I thought it was it's quite contemporary to try and to take that approach with that kind of character. We've seen obsessive fans done before, most notably The Fan, Robert De Niro, way back in the early 90s, I think, and Misery, which this film definitely uses as a touchstone. But the it's when you first meet the character, we'd already sort of seen trailers or whatever and photos of the hair, the unusual haircut that he's got and stuff. But we first meet him riding on a moped with his, helmet, dressed sort of quite geekily, unconventionally, sort of muttering to himself. And then it becomes quite apparent from after the first scene, the language, the way he's talking, that he's... that he is autistic, although they never say that. I think Travolta has gone on record as saying that's what he was going for. I liked his performance. I thought it was good. I thought it made the film quite interesting. The whole film has been quite controversial, quite maligned. I think unfairly so. A lot of people say it's a very bitter film and it doesn't like anyone. It doesn't like its main characters or us as an audience and stuff. I think that's a bit unfair. Travolta himself had an autistic son who died when he was only 16.
Yeah.
So Travolta has experience of that which he possibly drew on for the film. So I don't think there was, any idea of sort of trying to exploit anything or, go sort of, silly. I think Travolta takes what he's doing quite seriously. And for me, it added that extra dimension to the film, which might otherwise be, a fairly generic psycho thriller.
It is a very, how do I want to describe it? It's a performance which, it's almost like a black hole, the performance weighs more than the film around it and sort of sucks it in.
Okay.
It's a bit weird. I mean, opposite him we have Devon Sawa as the guy playing Hunter Dunbar,
who's from Life on the Line as well.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and his character's got a few issues. It's one of those things where as I said, you don't want to meet heroes. They've got feet of clay and that sort of thing, and he sees sort of behind the veneer a bit. But yeah, it's a much more nuanced performance. It's a lot more subtle, obviously. There are other sort of louder than life characters in there, like the thugs that keep bothering him and things like that. But
yeah,
it's just a bit bizarre for me.
Yeah, I mean, that Moose, who we never hear of what his full name is. He's only ever referred to as Moose. And he works, he makes his money on, I think, Sunset Strip he dresses up as an English Bobby.
Yeah.
Which is quite amusing, but he, you know, it's supposed to be jarring and stuff, but you know, he's it's all these sort of weird choices that they've made it. There's an interesting, I just want to, as a quick aside, there's scenes where Moose is riding around on his moped, and in the background of one of the scenes where he's going down the strip, the Church of Scientology is clearly obvious in the background. So I don't know if they must have done that on purpose, I don't know, but there's lots of little things. If you look around the film, I mean, even some of them are like really obvious. Like at one point, Hunter Dunbar's riding in the car and he puts on Limp Bizkit, which is, and they go, "Oh yeah, Limp Bizkit, brilliant!" You know, it's a bit like Fred Durst giving himself a little pat on the back. And there's other. I think, you know, the core is Travolta's performance. He goes full Nick Cage in this. You know, in other films, he's much more restrained, as we'll talk about in, you know, things. This is not a kind of a typical thing for Travolta to do. So you would really kind of expected, you know, Nicolas Cage to do something like this. But I think, I got on really well with it. And Hunter Dunbar, Devon Sauer, again, I think he did play it well. I think there's some really interesting observation, you know, what doesn't happen in the film is kind of quite interesting. So there's a fatality that occurs, which Moose is indirectly responsible for, but it goes completely unnoticed.
That and, really freaked me out, you know, because I'm watching it, I'm thinking, is anyone going to mention this? It's just, it's like, has anybody not noticed the dead body in the bloody driveway? You know, it's
funny. But I think that was intentional. It's like, I think Hunter Dunbar is just so wrapped up in himself that he's just not paying attention to those kind of things. In the same way, there's a reference later, and this touches on the similar thing to what MJ did, the short film we looked at a few episodes ago, of Moose is just posting all these outrageous, you know, things that he's doing on social media. But of course, nobody's noticing because nobody's following him. He doesn't have a, you know, nobody's looking in that direction. He could post whatever, he could post a, you know, the worst thing in the world. Nobody would see it because nobody cares about him.
Yeah.
So that, which is quite an interesting comment in itself. I thought the film, as it developed, it goes into this kind of, as I sort of mentioned earlier, misery kind of aspect. But that itself reminded me of a great film that Travolta did, I think, in the mid-90s called Mad City with Dustin Hoffman, which was a similar kind of, in that case, it was like a hostage situation thing. But it was kind of a simple guy in over his head, you know. But, yeah, Moose is just, his behavior is, you know, so wildly inappropriate that he just doesn't seem to get it. which is par for the course with, you know, autistic traits.
Yeah, it can be. Yeah. I don't think I've got anything else to say on this. But there were some interesting, as I mentioned, some artistic flourishes. You get these sort of like chalk drawings.
Yes.
Sort of throughout the film as well, as, you know, sort of, which I thought was quite interesting, sort of broke things up a bit. But in a way, that kind of reminded me of Jesse Johnson with his...
Yes, me too, yeah.
You know, debt collector with his cows. But so how are we going to score this, Rich? I'll go first. I'm going to give this one a 6 out of 10.
I'm going to go 7, but I've just got some sort of passing comments that's at the end. I thought the score, which used like a lot of violin and stuff, was perhaps a bit pretentious.
Yeah.
It's sort of trying to make it a sort of a bigger sort of character study kind of movie. The end credits repeat the opening credits, which really annoyed me because it's unnecessary. It's just a weird thing. So why put all the credits at the beginning and then put them all again at the end? You know, all the directed bys and stuff. And it comes up right at the end. It says John Travolta is Moose, which definitely seems like you would put that at the beginning. You know, I hate it. I mean, we often see credits where they go, we'll put them at the end and it says something presents. And it's like, well, no, you're not present. You've just presented it. It's just finished.
That makes me wonder if the film was originally going to be called Moose.
Maybe. That's an interesting thought. Could have been. I guess, what was the other thing? Oh, the film was dedicated to Bill Paxton. I don't know why, but it was.
Maybe he was originally going to be the Devon Sawa character.
Maybe. It's got narration, not for the first time. John Travolta's got this thing about doing films with narration. In this case,
we'll see later on.
Yeah, in this particular instance, the story is intermittently narrated by his friend, his only friend, really. Who's he's a young photographer character who's trying to get... So that was kind of a weird device. It didn't really add anything, I don't think, the narration. It didn't really go anywhere. The film's got quite an interesting conclusion, which doesn't kind of end as you might expect. I think it's definitely worth checking out. Yeah, I'd say a solid 7 out of 10 from them.
Yes, I'd definitely go with that. It's definitely worth a look, that's for sure. It's nowhere near as bad as people have been making it out to be. Just one really quick thing. You mentioned that it was dedicated to Bill Paxton. Bill's son, James Paxton, is actually in the film.
Ah, okay.
I think he plays the son of the guy. Sort of Devon Sawa's character. Not sure.
Slim. He plays a character called Slim.
So maybe he was one of the bullies.
Oh, yeah, that would make sense. Yeah, so he was. I think he was probably the guy who was the pickpocket guy.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, so a pretty solid 6 and 7 out of 10 for The Fanatic. Our next review is Speed Kills, the true story of Ben Aronoff, a speedboat mogul who had strong ties with the drug trade in Miami. Now, you just mentioned the fact that a lot of Travolta's films have a narration or a voiceover. This is no exception to that, although we'll talk a bit more about it towards the end of the review. This has, as you know, Rich, my big bugbear, the old in media res, starting at the end and then flashing back to the beginning. Very annoying. Although I do like that scene where he's staring down. What's the name of the actor?
Tom Sizemore.
How could I forget Tom Sizemore? Yeah, he's sort of basically staring down Tom Sizemore in his office. I thought that was a really good scene. But then we get this sort of denouement, and then we flash back to 1962, where Travolta kind of looks the same, but with Botox. He's a failed, well, not exactly a failed construction mogul.
He's supposed to be in his mid-30s, isn't he?
Yeah. But something goes tits up with his business, so he moves to Florida. He's already got ties to the mob, but he wants to sort of, you know, do things on his own. And he gets enthralled in the speedboat business. You know, he gets taken out for a ride. Absolutely loves the thrill of it, and he makes that his business basically. And then sort of later on, the sort of more sort of come into it. For the most part, I really like this. It is one of those films, you know, that it's been bounded around as like The Wolf of Wall Street. It's nothing like The Wolf of Wall Street at all. But it is one of those sort of, sort of rags to riches sort of stories. It has more in common with one of the other films we're going to be talking about later as well. But I thought Travolta was really good in this, you know, very solid. And, you know, this history from, like, you know, the 60s through to the 80s, it was just really, really interesting, I thought.
Yeah, this is coming... Again, like so many of the Travolta films we're probably going to talk about, it's coming for a huge amount of criticism, which I didn't really feel it deserved. I mean, I think it's a debut feature for its director. It's got some problems. Some of the budget doesn't seem to be there for some of the scenes. There's not a lot. Some of the set design, set dressing is a bit bare at times. And there's some weird transitions and stuff, like a lot of some fade to blacks that are used a bit awkwardly. There's some quite ambitious speedboat racing scenes, you know, involving green screen or CGI or whatever, which just do not work at all. They just look pretty terrible. There's some scenes where he's like celebrating victories because he's winning all these boat races, which look a bit naff. But in terms of its core construction and you know, the typical sort of gangster movie kind of thing, I think it does it absolutely fine. I didn't have a problem with Travolta, who looks, say, he's got that kind of over-tanned kind of look, but that's kind of the point. Yeah. That's for his character. He does fine. He's supported by a great cast, including James Remar, Catherine Winnick, Jennifer Esposito, Matthew Modine turns up as George Bush.
Yeah, that's quite funny.
It starts out when the character is 59 years old, whereas at this point Travolta was 65 years old. So then going back 25 years, that's quite tough to try and do. But in order, you know, it didn't have the budget of The Irishman or something to be able to use CGI in that. So apart from recasting and going back that route, which a lot of other directors or whatever may have done, I can overlook that, you know. It's like the film doesn't make a big point of when things are and how old people are. So therefore, unless you look into it, I don't think you're really going to think about it too much. The really odd thing that I just can't get around is this is the true life story of a guy called Donald Aronoff. Mm-hmm. So why is he called Ben Aronoff? Why did they fictionalize his name? Was there some sort of legal reason that they had to change it? Because everything else in the movie seems to be completely true. You know, you look up the cigarette boat and everything and the races, the footage from the film from the races. He had a boat called the Donzi, you know, named after himself. They don't change the name. They still call it the Donzi. Everything seems to be as it was. But for some reason, he's got a different name. Everyone knows it's a biopic of this guy. It's just calling him by a different name. There's a documentary floating around, which I'm quite interested, because it's an interesting story. I mean, this guy with ties to like Meyer Lansky and that, you know, getting involved in and really propelling speedboat racing into a huge thing, and you know, not being able to escape from his past and, you know, getting tied up with, you know, drug running and stuff. And so it's a good story. It perhaps could have been told better in the hands of a more experienced director like a Scorsese. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I wasn't bored at all. Kellan Lutz is in there as well.
Yeah.
I kept watching it thinking, is that Kellan Lutz? It must be, because he's quite a distinctive looking guy.
Yeah,
absolutely. And so I checked the credits. And I was like, yeah, so Catherine Winnick I liked in it. And so it's good. Yeah. I'd say it's not any... I don't think anybody should steer clear of it because of the bad reviews, frankly.
No, absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot going on in this. One of my favourite bits, actually, is the... You know, there's a scene where Kellan Lutz's character comes in and he basically, you know, forces them to sign off, you know, this lucrative contract to sort of... He basically steals all this these assets from him, you know, at gunpoint. And then a couple of weeks later, he comes back and they're going, yeah, the feds are sort of breathing down the neck. We need you to take all this stuff back. And he's just like, no, it's not mine anymore. You nicked it. You sort it out. Yeah, quite amusing. Yeah, so this has got a kind of narration. It sort of drops in and out, doesn't it? It's very half-hearted. There's a bit at the beginning, you know, when he's talking about his lawyer and things like that, how he hired this guy. Because he's hungry, you know, he's not sort of an established guy. But after that, it sort of just sort of wanes out and they sort of kind of forget about it for long periods.
Yeah, and it's one of those narrated from beyond the grave kind of devices.
Yeah, it's like who's narrating, you know, who's narrating it and who you're narrating it to, sort of thing, you know. But that's very strange. Yeah, good to see Tom Sizemore in this as well, in a small role.
I didn't really understand that scene at the beginning. It was all sort of, it's kind of coded, and you kind of think, is this like a verbatim conversation that was witnessed that they put into the script as a key thing, even though we don't actually really understand what a lot of it actually refers to. We're not quite sure. That, you know, there's a, it seems like there should be, there's quite a lot of weight behind this, but that's really the only time we see Sizemore. It's not when we go back in time. There's no more to that. It's
well, like, there is one other scene when he's driving with the guy with the beard, isn't there?
Yeah.
But other than that, nothing.
Yeah, so the people might not even recognise Sizemore in it. He looks quite different now to what I mean. He's been out of the lot, a bit more weathered. Yeah, he's been around the block, hasn't he? So a bit of a controversial turn of events with his career and stuff. But yeah, 6 out of 10 from me for this.
Yeah, I'll join you on a 6 for this one. It's a decent one. If it it's something, if it turns up on one of the streaming services, definitely worth a look. Our next Travolta slice is Gotti, where he plays the New York mobster John Gotti, and the film chronicles his rise and fall within the criminal underworld. Again, this is another one which sort of got a bit of a hammering by the critics. I think there's a lot of sort of Goodfellas-like kind of glib headlines attached to this. It does have a few issues, but again, a solid central performance from Mr. Travolta.
Yeah, I was expecting to see a real car crash, you know, because this got such a kicking. I thought it was going to be terrible, and I had no problem with it whatsoever. I was interested, engaged. Again, I thought Travolta's performance was really good. I mean, him getting a Razzie for worst actor just seemed ridiculous to me. I thought it was he did really well. The whole film built around it was okay. It might be derivative, but it was fine. Kevin Connolly, I think, from Entourage directed it. I'm not sure if he'd done anything else, but this was a film that I think took quite a long time to make, and there was lots of other actors, you know, Al Pacino or whatever, in the running or whatever, and they eventually got it made in 2017, but it didn't come out for like a year for whatever reason. But yeah, it's solidly made. It's got some of the, it's structurally quite similar to Speed Kills, which I think he made afterwards.
Yeah.
In that we've got Travolta narrating from beyond the grave as the character. The film starts more towards the present day, not in the present day because Gotti died in 2002, but sort starts more contemporary and then flashes back. So we've got Travolta again playing younger than, you know, he's mid-60s, but he's playing like 40 or something at one point. And they do the flip there is that they do that with his son. So we first meet his son in this contemporary scene before the flashback. So his son looks about 20. And then we flash back 20 years. And it's like, hang on a minute. how old is he supposed to be when we saw him at the beginning? So it's almost like it's more jarring that way. When you're a younger person, when you look really young and then you go back, you're supposed to go back to things. So I think he's supposed to be in like his 40s.
Sure.
In the more modern scene. So that was really odd, especially as I think his character, you know, he's playing John Gotti Jr., who was, you know, I don't know if he was consultant on the film, whatever, but he and his family certainly endorsed this film, which is a favourable portrayal of his father and him. His haircut, the guy playing him, his haircut just seemed so contemporary that it didn't fit the period. But that was really the only thing I could complain about, I think.
Yeah, well, I had a few complaints at the beginning of the film. As you said, the film opens, we're watching John Gotti Jr. being transferred into this room, and the scenes just seem to go nowhere. You know, it's just, they shoot a bit and then switch to another scene. You're thinking, all right, well, that was something, I guess. And it's not until they sort of reel his dad in that, it starts to sort of come together a bit. I really enjoyed this. You know, we all know, the thing is, the whole thing about sort of New York gangsters and things, it is a big caricature anyway, because we've seen the likes of The Sopranos and Goodfellas and The Irishman, and, you know, the whole sort of New York accent, and, you know, I believe Travolta, he came from New Jersey himself, you know, so not too far away. I suppose it is a fine line between sort of playing it straight and playing it, you know, as a caricature. But, you know, if you put that aside, I think it is a very solid performance. You know, there's only one or two scenes where he's sort of like, I think there's a couple of scenes where when he's arguing with his wife, it kind of comes across like an episode of Jersey Shore or something. You know, but for the most part, it's pretty straight. I mean, one of my favourite scenes is when he comes in, you know, after his son gets in trouble with that bar fight.
Yeah.
And he comes around and he's sort of slapping him and his mate, sort of going, you know, you don't understand the sort of trouble you've made and all this. I just really love that scene because it was just sort of really powerful. And there's sort of lots of other scenes like that. I thought that Stacey Keach was awesome in this. He plays his best mate, Neil De La Cruz. And then the other guy, Uncle Angelo, Pruitt Taylor, Vince.
Yeah.
Again, you know, a real solid performance. His character sort of unwittingly causes a lot of problems for the families and things like that. But no, I just thought it was really, really good.
Another couple of notables in the cast I would mention. So Kelly Preston, who is John Travolta's real-life wife, plays his wife Victoria in the film. And we've also got Chris Mulkey, who's a character actor who's been around for donkey's years. I think he's got like hundreds of credits to his name. But he actually, it was just coincidence, really. I rewatched Broken Arrow recently, like this week. And I've spotted Chris Mulkey in like a really short, like blink and you'll miss him, I think, almost bit part in that film. And then here he turns up as like fully fledged co-star, which I thought was quite good. So he turns up all over the place. I like him. He's a good actor. And interestingly, so Leo Rossi is in this, but he co-wrote the screenplay, which I couldn't believe. Leo Rossi, who's been like, you know, he's done gangster movies and stuff, but he's done like the Relentless, you know, serial killer movies and stuff back in the thing. And he's turned up in lots of B-movie, like Lloyd A. Samandel kind of films and stuff as well. But he's always quite a good presence. But I was just amazed to see that he'd written, I think this is only one of a few things that he's actually written. He co-wrote the script with Lem Dobbs, who's done a lot of other stuff, like The Limey, The Score.
Yeah.
Haywire, The Company You Keep, and he's been around for a lot. He's a screenwriter, he's been around for a long time. So I'm guessing Dobbs probably did the heavy lifting on the screenplay. But as a fan of certainly somebody who enjoys Rossi's work, that was a real pleasant surprise to see. And I thought I had no problem with the film whatsoever in terms of the way it was written. It's a flattering portrait. It's unapologetically, you know, admiring of things. But then again, aren't a lot of the gangster movies, glamorizing? You know, that's kind of par for the course. I mean, even the stuff we watch with Craig Fairbrass and that, it's all,
gangsters,
yeah. Yeah, it's like, oh, they're not so bad, are they? The Craze, that's a good example. It's like, oh, things were better when the Craze were around.
That's definitely the attitude of this film, isn't it? There's lots of these sort of vox pops sort of interspersed with people sort of going, they kept the scum off the streets and all this sort of stuff.
Very similar.
But yeah, no, this is, you know, if you like your gangster movies and things, there's a lot going on in here. There's a lot of the sort of inter-family politics and things, you know, so who said what to who and who should be made and all the rest of it. I didn't really have a problem with it, other than a few sort of technical issues at the beginning.
How about the music? Because there's quite a lot of hip-hop on the soundtrack, which seems an unusual fit in some cases.
Yeah, you're right. That did, especially towards the end, I noticed that more and more. And you know, obviously, I guess they're sort of trying to keep up with the times, you know, what they're sort of portraying. But it did just sort of like, it just sounded a bit weird.
Do you know who the score was by?
No.
The score was by Pitbull.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. Using his real name, but this was the first time he'd ever done a score. He contributes a song as well. Travolta, I think it must have been afterwards, has then appeared in a Pitbull music video as well. But you know, there's a sort of a through line on some of these films of like relationships of, you know, people have, you know, worked with each other in various other capacities. I think, like, what was it? Randall Emmett and George Furler, the producers. I think they're producers on this, but they produced one or two of the other films we're going to cover. I think I went off on a trail there. But no, it's just kind of, I think Travolta likes the people he's working with. He knows what he's doing. He gets involved. You know, you don't get a half-measured kind of performance with Travolta, I don't think.
I think that is the through line for all of these films. Unlike, say, Nicolas Cage, for example, he's either switched off or he's switched on.
Mm.
You know, there's no middle ground, basically. Either you're going to get the sort of the enhanced version or you're going to get the mundane version. You know, it's difficult to sort of find a middle ground with him. But with Travolta, you know, he's definitely playing different characters every time.
Yeah, you know, I think he's one of those actors you either like him or you don't. Mm. I think if you like Travolta, you're going to like most of his films. I think that's like my uncle, you know, he just won't watch anything with Travolta. He just doesn't get warm. You know, I feel that way about certain actors as well. But through this whole week that we've had of sort of having a look at, you know, all the Travolta films we haven't seen lately, I've sort of rediscovered him and sort of like remembered, you know, why I really have enjoyed watching his movies in the past. You know, this is like what, his fifth decade as a movie star?
Yeah.
You know, after establishing himself in the 1970s, you know, he's had his ups and downs, but, you know, it's no mean feat.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like you, I also revisited Broken Arrow this week.
Did you?
With Josh.
Excellent.
Yeah, and he got a lot out of it. So many helicopters getting exploded in that film. Anyway, scores on the doors for Gotti.
I'm going to go a 7 in this case.
I'm going to stick with a 6, but even so, I do recommend this. So this is on Netflix. We haven't mentioned this already, but Speed Kills is available on Netflix as well. This is on Netflix, and, you know, if you want a bit of gangster, check it out. Next up is Burning Rubber. Travolta plays a veteran racing driver called Sam Munro, who is incensed when his son Cam is lured by a rival racing team owned by his bitter rival Linsky. Forced to come out of retirement, Sam has to show Cam, Linsky, and everyone else that he is still a force to be reckoned with behind the wheel. I have to say, Rich, this is up till now my favourite of the films we've reviewed.
What?
I really, really like this. I really do.
Well, that is a shocker.
So, yeah, I just really got into this, you know, this sort of homespun story about, you know, these people working in this sort of racing circuit and there's the family rivalries and everything. You know, I just really, really enjoyed it.
That's fair enough. It's definitely more about the drama and the relationships than it is about the racing.
True.
In my view, I guess it's kind of quite appropriate for the setting that it's quite slow paced.
Mm.
It's quite, you know, it sort of drifts along. It's not really a lot of, I mean, there's a major event that happens about halfway through the movie, but even that kind of they don't linger on that actually as much as you think. It kind of then moves on to like other things. Kind of, yeah. It was originally called Trading Paint.
Mm-hmm.
I've renamed it. I don't think it's just known as Burning Rubber here, but that is the thing. I don't think either title really fit the movie that well, because you do expect like a Days of Thunder kind of thing. And it's quite interesting because it's set in a world of motor racing that I wasn't really aware of, which is the Talladega dirt track racing.
Yeah.
And they've got these quite distinctive, like a fiberglass body kind of
the cars. Yeah, the cars have a weird shape to them, don't they?
Yeah.
They're not symmetrical, you know, they sort of lean into one side of it, I suppose, because they're always just going around in one direction.
but... There was a couple of jarring things. This is one of, I think, like three films. I think like one of three or four actually like four films that Travolta's done which involve a relationship with a son. But this is probably, I mean, Gotti had quite a lot of that, but they didn't dwell on it too much because it was more of a biopic. But this one is central. That is the core thing about this, is the relationship with his son, and his son being lured away by Michael Madsen.
Yes,
as the sort of who really must be smoking way too much, because his voice is
rough, isn't it? Yeah,
it's so rough. It's practically disappeared. It's gone. You won't be able to understand him soon. It's like Nick Nolte.
It's like a fag packet away from a voice box, basically, isn't it?
it's absolutely. So he's got this. So there's this fallout. Sam is like, is it Sam who's the main character?
Yeah, Sam's the dad. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's kind of fallen out with his son. He doesn't really drive. He's a veteran. He's won loads of awards and everything, and he doesn't really do it anymore. But when his son goes over to the other side, he basically has to, because if he doesn't race, nobody's going to race for him. Yeah. So it then becomes a father-son battle on the track. You know. His son's being lured to the dark side, and bad stuff happens.
The racing
scenes are all right, but then I didn't think they didn't have a huge amount of energy for me.
I thought they were okay. Certainly better than Redline, the film that we reviewed in one of the previous episodes.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
What about Travolta's hairline in this? What was going on with that?
I thought his hair looks actually pretty decent in this one compared to some of the others.
I didn't really notice it as much as in. I mean, in this, it was just the line, like the connecting line in his forehead. I don't know. That was quite distracting. Have you noticed he has a beard in a lot of these movies as well lately? He likes the beard. He likes to keep the beard. I wondered if this was like a biopic, but it doesn't seem to be.
Yeah.
I think it's based on script they came up with. Shania Twain appears in the movie as his girlfriend. She doesn't have a lot to do.
She doesn't have a lot to do. She's there to be
a name.
A lot of exposition goes her way. You know, she's there as our surrogate in a way.
Absolutely. So she gets to discover all these awards that he's won when he walks in the thing. The car you must never touch.
That was a bit over the top when she goes in the garage and they thought, yeah, because he's obviously been a successful racing driver, and he says, "Oh, I've won a few awards." And then he goes in the garage, and there's like thousands of trophies.
The warehouse from the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Exactly. I think the prop department went a bit overboard here. They could have scaled it back a little bit. But the guy won a shit ton of trophies, that's for sure. I was kind of surprised that. They didn't reveal. I don't know if this was the intention or not, but the origin of the rivalry between Linsky and Monroe was perhaps that he'd been involved in the car accident that killed his wife. Because you only see us for a split second. Because what looks like happened, that a car sort of overtook him and another car, then the other car had to slam on his brakes and he sort of smashed into the back of him.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't actually sort of reveal who, and from the, from his son, you find out that he's never really talked about what happened. You know, he's always kept shtum about it, and everyone kind of assumes that he lost control in the rain or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering if he's just going to sort of drop it in at some point, maybe when his son's in hospital, that Linsky was in the other car or something. But no, he never actually does. Even though Linsky wants to buy the Mustang, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's probably, there might have been some deleted scenes or, things got trimmed down a bit. It's hard to say. The other thing I wanted, apart from Michael Madsen, we've also got Kevin Dunn playing very different kind of character to who I've seen Dunn play before. He's been in stuff like Hot Shots, where he was like the assistant to, or not assistant, but he was like talking a lot with Lloyd Bridges' character. But here he's like full on gruff beard kind of thing, playing a guy called Stumpy, who's Sam Monroe, John Travolta's character's best friend. I really liked him in it. And we've also got, it's funny because I was thinking about War Games around the same time, and Barry Corbin from War Games turns up as the deputy.
Right.
In one of the scenes, I think he's the host of the Trading Paint radio show Sam Monro goes on. And he looked really old, but I did kind of think, I'm pretty sure that's him. And I checked the IMDb and it was. And so, yeah, there's that. The real sort of sticking point for me was the casting of his son, Cam. Mm-hmm. And that I didn't feel that Toby Sebastian in that role was strong enough, it certainly compared to like the relationship that we see in Gotti. You know, there's a certain strength in I don't know the actor's name so playing that character, but you know, he looks quite meek when you first see him, but he was quite good. In this one, there's a lot of bluster, you know, like bravado is like strong, you think, but I don't know. I didn't really buy it, buy their relationship. I think they needed a stronger, perhaps more established, like a Devon Sauer to play that role, I think, in my view. And that would have improved some of the problems for me.
Yeah. Fair point. I think, the woman...
I didn't care about his scenes, basically.
I think the woman playing his wife had stronger scenes, that's for sure. You know, she was sort of the one sort of trying to doing her best to sort of hold the whole family together, basically.
Yeah.
Which I thought was quite good. Yeah, I don't know. This just got me in the right mood, I guess. It caught me in the right mood. It's not overly schmaltzy, I don't think. It's a reasonable sort of drama. I quite like the racing scenes. You know, the central incident is done really well.
How did you feel about the conclusion?
It was okay.
Because I know it's a certain level of formulaicness to it, but there's a bit like it's all sort of happening, and this song kicks in,
yes,
and it just killed the scene for me. I was just like that's just like ruined. It just completely the film just fell flat at that point, and then before the credits kicked in, which I thought was a shame, because I think if they'd have just let that scene develop a bit more organically, I think that might have works a bit better and end a bit on a bit more of a triumphant, you know, Rocky-ish kind of note. I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, for me, this was deliberate. It didn't deliver anything particularly novel or interesting. Didn't, I guess, catch me at the right time. Although I was really keen to see it. I was looking forward to it. So I'm going to have to go 5 out of 10.
Even though I did enjoy it, I think I'm going to have to stick with a 6. So... I definitely
haven't you given something else a 7?
Not yet.
Not yet? No, okay.
All 3 are 6s from me so far.
Okay.
So, yeah, so a 6 out of 10 for me and a 5 out of 10 from Rich. That is Burning Rubber, which I believe is on Prime.
Yeah. I mean, it's available on most platforms, but yeah, if you've got a Prime membership, you can watch
it for free. Yeah, definitely worth wasting time on. Our penultimate review is Eye for an Eye, also known as The Poison Rose. In this one, Travolta plays private investigator Carson Phillips, who is lured back to his hometown in order to solve a missing persons case. But while he is there, he gets embroiled in drug dealers, gambling, match-fixing, extortion, and even murder, involving a lot of his old friends from high school, and possibly his ex-wife too. Okay, so this is very much... this is a meandering story, this one, Rich. It does take a while to sort of get into gear, to get into the main story. There's a lot of meandering around. But once he's, you know, on the right track, I must admit I enjoyed this one quite a lot.
I did too. Takes its cues from old film noir detective stories. That's really obvious. I think it opens with a shot of a cinema showing the Maltese Falcon, that's which is correct. Perhaps a bit, it's aiming for. It doesn't quite hit those heights, obviously. But the film itself was good, I thought. I liked his character. I thought it was interesting. Again, liked his performance. Another film with narration.
Yep.
Because it's a detective movie, though.
It fits.
That really fits. Mm. And it's relevant, and he's sort of contributing those narrative comments at various points throughout the story as it's unfolding. The cast is brilliant. This is the first time he's worked with Morgan Freeman, who's in not as many scenes as you might expect, although he is a key player. But we've also got Famke Janssen, Robert Patrick, Peter Stormare,
Brendan Fraser,
I was gonna say Brendan Fraser because we might as well do it now. I love Brendan Fraser in this. What is he doing? I mean, he's doing like what's his name?
Peter Lorre kind of performance, isn't it?
Well, or what's the other one? Truman Capote.
Oh yeah.
It's like he's kind of talking like this, and he's working in the asylum kind of
sanitary or something. I don't know. He's really going for it, like full on. He's a big guy in this. He's not in his mummy.
He just doesn't give a fuck anymore, does he? Basically, he's not getting films like The Mummy anymore. So it's just like, I'm going full Brando now.
Yeah, it's that's a good comparison. I think it's kind of a Brando-ish performance. His character is definitely memorable. He's plays kind of quite a key part in the story, but is which is quite a meandering, at times quite confusing story. But yeah, out of everyone, I mean, Robert Patrick is Robert Patrick. Peter Stormare is Peter Stormare. Famke Janssen is the sort of she kind of seems like she's going to be a proper femme fatale, and it only really sort of touches on that a little bit. But Brendan Fraser sort of really stands out. So yeah. I'd recommend the film. If you like Travolta, and see it for him and that. But more than the Morgan Freeman factor, don't worry about that because Freeman's just doing the same thing he always does. But Fraser is well worth seeing in this. The what else was I going to say? So we've got the film is detective stories. Down on his luck, he goes back home and meets up with all his old friends. His old flame, played by Famke Janssen. Now, there's some cheesy stuff there with some of their interactions. They're a bit like, it's a bit doesn't quite work. But for the most part, it's all right. And there's this, she's got a daughter called Becky, who's played by John Travolta's actual daughter, Ella Blue Travolta. Read into that what you will. And she's fine. There's a thing, but there's a character called Rose, who is seems to, so the original title, I have to get onto the title of this film. The original title of the film was The Poison Rose, which seemed to be alluding to her character and her character being poisoned or whatever. But she isn't actually in it very much and doesn't have any actual huge amount of bearing on the plot. So the title, The Poison Rose, for me, even though they changed it, still doesn't fit the film that well, but the title that Signature Entertainment released it with, Eye for an Eye, is just completely off the reservation.
I think the title of Poison Rose alludes to the casino that Morgan Freeman runs. I think it's called the Rose, or it's called the Purple Rose, I think.
Oh, is it? Okay.
But you're absolutely right. And the title, Eye for an Eye, what does that mean in this context, in this film's context?
Well, they're trying to sell it as a revenge movie, aren't they?
Yeah.
But I mean, which to a certain extent it is. There is an aspect of revenge in there, or at least vengeance of some description.
We'll give the story a bit of a fleshing out then. Travolta's character is approached by a woman in his office in LA to find out what's happened to her aunt, who's in an asylum in his hometown, and because he's getting a bit of heat from one of his previous clients, he decides to go and take a look. And while he's down there, the sort of local hero, sort of football quarterback, ends up dying mid-game, and there's a suggestion that maybe he was murdered, and maybe his wife, which is Famke Janssen's daughter, may have been the murderer. So he gets involved in trying to clear her name as well. So there is a lot going on in this film. Lots of different sort of, it's a very tangled web, but, it does sort of manage to sort of give you a decent, join the dots at the end, I think.
Yeah, I think for me, the revelations that come at the conclusion were a bit unsatisfactory, But overall, it's such an easy watch. This is the kind of movie that I would have loved sitting and watching with my man, who liked detective stories and whatever. It'd be part of. I mean, there's nothing really particularly offensive or anything in this film. I think there's a couple of bits of language and a little bit of violence, but it's very accessible, I think, this. And if the sense of location is really good. Where was it set? Was it Alabama? Something like that?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so the location's really good. It was directed by George Gallo, although he's the credited director, but there's also the writer, or one of the writers, Francesco Cinquemani, gets a co-director, or gets a co-director credit on the IMDb. So quite what happened there, I'm not sure, but he's a director as well. So there was some sort of handover at some stage, I think, between the two directors. But I don't think there's nothing particularly detrimental in what I can see. The film looks very consistent in its tone, and I really recommend it. I think it's for me it's one of the best ones, and I'm going to give this 7 out of 10.
I'm going to join you on a 7. It does take a bit, as I said, bear with it in its opening scenes as it sort of pulls itself together. But overall, this, if you like sort of decent detective stories, this is definitely worth checking out.
So, I have to mention before we finish, actually, it's set in the 1970s.
That's true. Yeah. No cell phones.
No. So they don't dwell on it too much, and but I think it's got a bit. It's of all these films that we've seen, which like Speed Kills and Gotti or whatever, which all go back in time. I thought the sense of place and location actually worked quite well with this, even though there's not a huge amount of dwelling on explicit signs of the time.
No, that's true, like
particular fashion and stuff.
It's pretty timeless. It's almost like
exactly.
Like the Deck Collector is pretty timeless.
Yeah. I think that's good. Yeah, I think that's what I'm saying. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So 2 sevens for Eye for an Eye. Check it out. So our DTV throwback this week is The Forger, made back in 2014. John Travolta stars as Ray Cutter, an excellent forger who cuts a deal with his old boss to get out of prison 10 months early in order to spend more time with his terminally ill son, Will. There is a heavy price to pay, however. Ray must forge a Monet painting and switch out the real one while it's on display at the local museum. Again, thoroughly enjoyed this one, Rich. Apart from some of the sort of more schmaltzy sort of drama bits with his son, I thought this was a really decent caper movie. And also, I think this is sort of the hardest character that he's played out of all these films. Ray Cutter is a tough guy, basically. And he doesn't take shit from anyone, which I really enjoyed. There's a particular sequence where he's trying to track down his ex-girlfriend or ex-wife and goes to see this guy in a tattoo parlor and ends up in a huge fight. And it's all shot from like a camera like way above street level. And I just thought it was excellent. The fact that these guys are sort of laying into him and he gets up, they all walk off. He goes to his car, picks out a bloody baseball bat and just finishes them all off, basically. I just thought that was a brilliant moment in a rather decent film.
That is a very memorable scene. Perfect for filming with a double because, that doesn't have to be an issue.
That is a good point.
I mean, I haven't seen many sort of long take scenes like that. I mean, you literally are a really long way away as if you're on a building rooftop, down the road or something, but it really works. It works brilliantly. The film's directed by a guy called, Philip Martin, who's done loads of British TV, like The Crown, The Tunnel, Poirot, Volander, so he hasn't done many features. So he'd gone over to America to make this one. And I thought it did, it's done a really solid job. The film is another example of Travolta being interested in like gangster characters again. There's also, as we've said, with Burning Rubber and Gotti, there's that whole angle of it's about his relationship with his son. That's quite a big part of it, but it's also the other stuff going on. The heist-ish elements really take a back seat until the last part of the film, like the third act. The father-son stuff I thought worked really well. Ty Sheridan plays his son. But the real most notable actor, actor in the support is Christopher Plummer playing his dad, who's brilliant.
Absolutely, yeah.
Who's like, who really, he's like a crotchety old crook. But at the end, he's like getting involved. It's like family business, you know, the Matthew Broderick, Sean Connery and Dustin Hoffman film. So the whole family's getting involved. And he's like sharp as a tack, you know, kind of thing. And hard. He's pretty tough in the movie, despite his age. So he was good. Two things which I wasn't particularly keen on. One, Travolta's little tiny goatee.
Oh God! I just just want to get hold of a Bic razor and just finish it off. Having said that, I stopped noticing it after the first few scenes, I must admit. But yeah, when you first see him, it's just like you're just drawn to this stupid tuft of hair on the end of his chin. It's like, oh God, no. But anyway.
And the second thing is that the plot relies on you believing that Travolta is a skilled enough artist to be able to recreate a flawless copy of a Monet painting, which is a bit like when Steven Seagal got cast as a Harvard professor or something, you know, or whatever it is in Out for a Kill. But so that whole bit of him, I mean, that they tackle it well in the film. I mean, in terms of he's doing the brush strokes and stuff, but actually I'm in no way convinced that that would have even been remotely possible.
You know what sold me on that though is there's an earlier scene because part of his plan is to get an old painting from that was made in the same year as the Monet, and then use the paint from that to do the other painting, because the paint wouldn't have the same oxidants and pollutants and things in it. And he goes to see this guy who's selling two paintings, and the spiel he gives him about the artist, I thought, yeah, he seems like a credible. You know, he knows his stuff, basically, the way he's able to sort of talk about this particular artist. And even then, he sort of says he was a terrible painter, you know, but he knew all these other painters and, you know, he's part of the art scene. And that. I thought, yeah, that was a dead serious, really interesting scene. And that kind of sold me for the rest of it when he's sort of making... I mean, his only experience is to go right up to the Monet painting and stare at it for a long time, you know. And then go back and paint it. But, I was kind of sort of sold on the idea of him being this sort of master forger.
Not ironically, but coincidentally, I rewatched the old Rowan Atkinson film Bean earlier today, in which Mr. Bean accidentally defaces Whistler's mother, the picture of Whistler's mother, because he's supposed to be over there representing the National Gallery to present the thing. And he has to go back and change it so that people don't notice it's been defaced before they launch it. So he like does this envelope plan or whatever, where he uses a poster of the painting and he sprays some stuff on it. So he puts it on the frame and everything so that everyone looks at it and they think it's a painting, but it's actually the poster with some stuff. And I actually probably thought that was probably a better plan / execution, or, you know, more convincing maybe, even though it's a terrible film. That was probably a bit more in line with, you know, the sort of, there's a similarity there in what they did in this film, although they take the whole stealing the painting thing seems to happen really quite easily, quite quickly. But there is a nice payoff because there's this, there's an investigation basically happening parallel to all of this, and they're keeping an eye on what, what's Travolta's character's name? Cutter, yeah. So they're keeping an eye on what Cutter's doing, and so they know what he's up to. And they're like, the partner keeps saying, you know, he's broken his parole like five times. How much longer are we going to let him get away with it? But there is quite a nice payoff with, you know, who the real baddies are, you know, because he's like lovable rogue kind of character. Mm. And I thought the actual conclusion of the film was one of the strongest of all those that we've watched. It's a nicely shot, nicely told story, and all the stuff, father son stuff, I thought worked really quite nicely. And I say Christopher Plummer's amazing, so yeah, well worth seeing.
Absolutely. Unfortunately,
I forgot to say Jennifer Ely is in it, the British actress. She turns up as Cutter's ex-wife, which was quite random. I'm not used to seeing her in a role like that. Anyway, so yeah. Apologies for the interruption.
Yeah, we've also got Abigail Spencer in there, who people might remember from films like Cowboys and Aliens and numerous TV stuff.
I've never seen Cowboys and Aliens.
I quite enjoyed
Should I? Is it any good?
Yeah, I quite enjoyed it. But anyway. so I was really worried going into this about the father-son stuff. Having watched the... what's that Nicolas Cage one? Where he gets out of prison and ends up with his son.
Oh.
Where he's sort of like getting revenge on everyone from.
Yes. Now, this is funny because this was a film that kept coming to mind, and I couldn't remember the name of it because I know we've watched quite a few Nick Cage films lately. Yeah, the central relationship in that film was, again, coming to mind quite a lot.
But I felt this was handled a bit better. I thought, you know, the character, score to settle. But I thought Ty Sheridan was really good in this. He's not an actor I've really grown to like, although I watched Ready Player One with my son the other day, and, you know, I must admit, didn't hate him as much as I did the first time I watched it. So, yeah, maybe he's growing on me a bit.
Is he British or American?
I have no idea.
I presume he's American. He's
been not American. Interested to find out.
No, I'm not. I don't really know much of his life. Didn't he do? He did a film with Nicolas Cage. Mm. With wasn't it Joe? Did he do Joe?
Oh yeah.
So yeah, so he's one of those actors on the rise. Mm. So this was like a few years ago, but he's still in DTV. I mean, he had a film, The Night Clerk, I think, come out
a while back.
So he's still kind of, he's in these big movies occasionally, but he's one of those guys who's sort of,
and
some of his films are just not making it. But he was good in it. I mean, it's quite a tough role to, you know, be a young actor sort of playing, you know, this difficult relationship with your father and be terminally ill as well. I do recommend it.
Absolutely. Now, unfortunately, Amazon Prime are about to get rid of this.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's available to rent, though, isn't it?
It's available to rent, but unfortunately, it's not going to be one of their freebies for much longer. But, you know, if it comes back or if you happen upon it anywhere, definitely check it out.
Yeah, you might be able to get a cheap DVD copy somewhere.
In fact, we haven't even scored it yet, right? We don't score the throwbacks, do we?
We don't score the throwbacks, but shall we in this instance?
I would give it a 7.
You give it a 7? Yeah, I'll give it a 7 as well. Mm-hmm.
Now, before we wrap up, Rich, I think, you know, we've covered 6 whole films tonight. What was your sort of overall impression of Mr. Travolta at 65?
I was very impressed. I mean, having sort of been put off to a certain extent by a lot of the bad reviews and that we've heard, you know, I feel like I rediscovered him this week. As I said earlier, you know, he's fairly committed. He's probably one of the best guys doing DTV movies at the moment. I mean, really, I mean, you compare him to, like, you know, whatever, who else is there? Bruce Willis, great example, Bruce Willis. I mean, Bruce Willis is just coasting in so many of his movies. He's another one who I haven't actually given him fair shot because I haven't watched a lot of these movies because of the bad reviews, but I will check them out. But Travolta seems to really commit to every sort of every role that he does. He's not being the same character, even though he's, you know, doing a lot of the similar things, like the gangster thing he does, but there's different interpretations. Whereas a Bruce Willis, whatever, is just going to sort of turn up, maybe not even be in the film that much. I mean, compared to Nicolas Cage is another good example. So I think Travolta outshines Nicolas Cage for me, in terms of quality of the work in each of the consecutive films.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'd put Antonio Banderas on par with Travolta. I made a note a couple of years ago. He had four films out in the space of about 6 months, and each time it was a completely different performance. You know, it really, really was, and each time he knocked it out of the park. So yeah, I'd put someone like Banderas up there as well. But yeah, you know, in future I'd be definitely sort of looking out for more Travolta projects.
Now, before we, another thing before we finish up, I just want to kind of go over a couple of the other movies, which I think are most of the, I think these ones all did go to ETV, just to see whether you've seen them or, you know much about them. So I'm going to go back to 2013, Killing Season, with Robert De Niro.
Yeah. Again,
do you know much about that one? Did you see it? I did.
I quite enjoyed it.
Travolta's got this kind of strange haircut beard combination.
He has, So he's like from the Balkans, and he's after De Niro because De Niro had killed his son on a mission or something, and he's sort of hunting him down. And then I thought that was pretty decent. Yeah, quite enjoyed that one.
In a Valley of Violence, directed by Ty West.
So that's with Ethan Hawke.
Yeah.
And Travolta plays a sheriff who's got a broken leg, or it's either a broken leg or one leg, one of the two. I think he might just have one leg. That also had Karen Gillan in it.
I was just about to say that.
And I really did not like her performance in that particular film.
Oh, right, okay.
And that came out more or less the same time as the first Guardians of the Galaxy, and I didn't like her performance in that either.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't until I saw the second Guardians of the Galaxy where she discovered the nuances of her character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the first one, she was very shouty henchman kind of role.
Was she Nebula?
Yes.
Yes, Nebula. Or is she?
She is Nebula, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, her performance in the second Guardians of the Galaxy was brilliant, you know, and brought the character to life. But, so in that one, she plays the wife of the sheriff's son, who's a real sort of boorish, sort of like violent arsehole. And she kind of enables him quite a lot, you know, sort of egging him on to beat people up and stuff like that. That was an interesting role for Travolta, that one. You know, much more talky, you know, it's sort of almost sort of Quentin Tarantino-ish, you know, in his little sort of tics and things. But, yeah.
And the other one was, again, I think these are all DTV. John Travolta in this one. It starred Michael Pitt and Dan Stevens, Criminal Activities. Did you see that one?
I'm just going to quickly look that up. Criminal Activities.
That was, interestingly, directed by Jackie Earle Haley, who from Watchmen and Nightmare on Elm Street playing. And again, I think Travolta's playing a gangster.
No, I haven't seen that one.
I'm quite curious to check. Now that we've done this, I'm quite curious to continue my little foray and maybe check out some of these, especially that Robert De Niro one. I'm really quite intrigued.
Yeah, that was quite
about that.
Yeah.
Well, what a journey it's been, Mike.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, you see John Travolta's name, you know, maybe don't sort of stick your nose up. Give it a shot. We were very entertained by all six films, and you may be too. So thank you for listening, and tune in again next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments, and tune in again next time.